Hi, this is Paul Siegel, and you're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and on this episode of Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about using miniatures in your gaming. Should you play D&D with miniatures or without? How can you procure them? What kinds of protocols will surround that decision for your game? And how does it affect your online gaming, in fact? So a whole lot of stuff here on miniatures, and we're delayed by about a minute or two, because as usual, Paul and I got chatting right before the show, and we were really deep into it, and then we were like, wait a minute, we're past the time when the show should start.
Yeah, so, I think folks have probably heard me say many times on this show that our show started really as an excuse for us to just shoot the shit. So, what do you know? It happens.
Time to turn that camera on at this point. Yeah. So I think that as I prep for this, so this might spawn multiple different episodes potentially. I think that the theme for me is there's been this constant struggle or wrestling match throughout, you know, the existence of D&D between miniatures and no miniatures. And even in the same book or in the same edition, there's been this struggle about, do we emphasize the miniatures or do we emphasize what now people refer to as theater of the mind or narrative play? And so there's always been this kind of built-in awkward contradiction about whether you want to do that or not. And I'll just start with, okay, so very first thing, as we've said many times, right? So here is the original Dungeons & Dragons box from 1974.
Dan, I'm gonna stop you. Before we dig too deep into it, I just want to point out, like, I think there's, you know, I think even before the current situation we're in with everyone, you know, being stuck in their own houses and having to switch to all, you know, digital remote play, I think a lot of people have pretty strong feelings about this. A lot of people are going to be very strongly pro miniatures or very strong anti miniatures. And that's maybe more going to inform how we adapt to playing over the internet than vice versa, right? Than having to say, well, we have to play over the internet. Should we use miniatures or not?
Right.
Sorry, that was my one thought. I just wanted to do that, mention that before we get into the thick of it. But I won't be surprised as we go into this if we see chatters who feel strongly about use of miniatures or not.
Let me ask this. As you and I have gamed for a number of years, has your feeling towards miniatures been the same throughout your gaming career, or has that even, you know, vacillated for you personally?
It's definitely vacillated strongly for me. I mean, I like miniatures in their own right as their own hobby, right? I used to play, I think you and I both used to play Warhammer with a coworker of ours who was super into
it. Tiny little bit.
Yeah.
For me, tiny little bit. You and BJ and so forth did more of it than I did.
Right. Yeah, so we played some Warhammer and got really into the hobby of that. And I always sort of thought there's kind of two hobbies at play here, right? There's both the hobby of collecting and painting and building at terrain and all that kind of like crafty miniature stuff.
Right.
And then there's the hobby of playing a war game with them. And the thing that always struck me with Warhammer was that there was a lot of people who were very strongly in one of those two camps or possibly interested in both sides of the fence.
Right.
You know, the real, like, serious, I think, the very dedicated, should I say, Warhammer players really tended to enjoy both aspects. But I had played with plenty of people who just loved to paint miniatures and were terrible at the game. And I played with plenty of people who loved the game and felt like painting their miniatures was a tedious chore.
Yep. That's a good point. That's a good point, too. And I'll also say, you know, that's something that as people's lives have been disrupted lately, I've seen multiple people on Twitter saying, maybe it's time for me to get back into painting miniatures now that I have more time. Or maybe I should, you know, get into miniature painting for the first time ever.
I like this thought here from Ash. Pro mini versus pro thought. I totally agree, Ash. Nobody wants to be anti anything. Yeah, that's. I think that's apt. There's. I don't want to imply here in any direction that using miniatures or not using miniatures is better or the right way to play. Like you just asked, have my feelings changed radically, back and forth? These days I would say I probably just land on the like, well, what are we playing? Right? Yes. What kind of game are we playing? And then, and not even just like, is it OD&D or is it 5th edition, but like specifically what module are we playing?
Yep, great. Yep, well put. And I mean, as a top level thing, I'll say that you and I have both had a great time in different situations playing with miniatures and without miniatures. So we've totally had wonderful experiences with both. And I would, that's a great point. If it even comes down to what particular module, what particular adventure are you running, possibly makes a huge difference. That's a really great point.
Yep.
Let me.
All right. Okay. OD&D. Yeah. Go back.
Here's my deep dive. So as I say a number of times on the show, right? Here's the original D&D box from 1974, and this is at a point when they didn't have the phrase role playing game to hang your hat on. That was going to be something that people came up with later to describe what happens in D&D. And so the subtitle in the box here is Rules for Fantastic Medieval War Game Campaigns Playable with Paper and Pencil and Miniature Figures. So miniature figures is in the subtitle here, but if you open up the book, like in the first one or two pages, it says miniatures. Well, you could use it, but they're optional and they never talk about it again. the side of the box here, this side of the box says fantasy game rules. And maybe that's a more succinct, branding of it at the time.
Yeah.
But so obviously this came out of wargaming, right? So there was a whole wargaming scene in the 40s, 50s, 60s. And this is something that they could put on the cover of the box to be recognizable as a thing that is sort of like stuff we already have, and attract the wargamers and clearly come out of the chainmail wargame. But very quickly in the book, it doesn't actually talk about miniatures anywhere in the original D&D books, even though it's on the cover.
Yeah, I mean, sure, for sure, I think that incredibly verbose subtitle on the cover comes out of the fact that they were inventing something so new that there was simply no way to describe it in a way that would be recognizable to someone who isn't already in the know, right? Like, you're dealing with... Yeah. And then, of course, I think that's how D&D originally spread, right? Is people in the know teaching each other, you know, kind of had this, viral spread, if you will. Yeah. But eventually it becomes mainstream enough that people are just going by, well, what do I see on the box? Famously, my father bought the basic set for my mom because she likes that kind of dragons and stuff.
Yep.
Like, and neither one of them had any idea what the heck it was.
I can totally see that.
Yeah.
I can totally see that. I had a really close friend that had that basic D&D set, and it said, you know, for, you know, ages 12 and up, and I think he got it at age 10 or something like that. So he very religiously put it on the shelf and said, well, I'm not allowed to open that until I'm 12. And I'm like, screw that, man. Give me that. Give me that, and I'll start running a game in 15 minutes.
Actually says 10 and up, and I remember having that thought myself I was going to get in trouble. I was like, ooh, it says ages 10 and up, and I'm under 10. Somebody's going to catch me.
I mean, some of us actually did get in trouble for playing D&D back in the day. That wasn't completely an insane thought.
Probably not for being under 10 years old, right? Like, not they weren't like, that's, well, the book says 10.
It's true, but there was, you know, there was this whole aura around it. If there was a bit of risk and there was a bit of, danger around it at the time.
Sure, but now you're getting into the satanic panic stuff. Let's go back to miniatures. Miniatures. So the box says that you're supposed to use miniatures, but then the interior text says, you don't need them.
Correct. And so I see that Ash had a comment like about five back there about saying from what he's heard, Gygax never used miniatures. And can you bring up that quote?
Well, I got to find it.
It's like four back in the list right now. Not sure about Arneson, that quote there.
Yeah. There you go. Okay.
So anyway, so one of our viewers, there you go. So Ash is saying, not sure about Arneson. All the anecdotes I've heard is that Gygax never used minis. And there's a lot of evidence that you are correct about that. And in fact, one of the things that I wanted to pull up here was one of the most fascinating Dragon magazine articles that Gygax ever wrote. And so this is all about miniatures and all about the problems of scale that are baked into D&D. So this is from June 1978, and it's talking about the specifics of the original scale, and it goes on for many, many, many paragraphs about Dave Arneson using the original chainmail rules and what they thought the scale ought to be, and the transition they did from outdoor armies to indoor man-to-man dungeons, which wasn't exactly right, he admits. It's one of the very rare times that Gygax actually outright says, we didn't get this right, and we needed to fix it. I find that to be very, very unusual for him. And then I think it's Len Lakofka, I think, points out a problem with what they're doing at some point, and he has to fix it. And so about 10 paragraphs in, so this is a little bit long. I'm going to read it in its entirety because I think it's so fascinating. And he says here, for about 2 years, D&D was played without benefit of any visual aids by the majority of enthusiasts. They held literally that it was a paper and pencil game, and if some particular situation arose which demanded more than verbalization, they would draw or place dice as tokens in order to picture the conditions. In 1976, a movement began among D&Ders to portray characters with actual miniature figurines. So that's 1976, right? That's 2 years after they released D&D. Mm-hmm. Miniature figure manufacturers began to provide more and more models aimed at the D&D market, characters, monsters, weapons, dungeon furnishings, etc. Availability sparked interest, and the obvious benefits of using figures became apparent. Distances could be pinned down, opponents were obvious, and a certain extra excitement was generated by use of painted castings of what players actually saw. Because of the return of miniatures to D&D, the game is tending to come full circle, back to tabletop battles not unlike those which were first fought with D&D's parent Chainmail's Fantasy Supplement, now occurring quite regularly. Unfortunately, the majority of D&D enthusiasts did not grow up playing miniature figurines, so even the most obvious precepts of tabletop play are arcane to them, and then he complains about people not intuiting scale issues that he didn't write down. But I thought that was really, that's one of the most fascinating quotes I know of the idea the game is tending to come full circle from miniatures to non-miniatures back to miniatures. And he's writing this in 1978.
It's interesting.
And at this point, I don't know how many cycles we've had since then, but even in 1978, talking about 1976, you could say there's been a whole cycle at that point.
You know, I what really caught me about that section you just read was, the pessimist in me sort of hears the notion of, well, it turns out we found that we could sell more product by incorporating miniatures more. Ergo, you're going to use miniatures.
Yeah, and I think that's true. And I think that because when you switch to first edition, and again, I didn't like this product was predates my getting into the hobby. I was too young for this, and so when I was getting into it in the first edition era, the DM, the Dungeon Master's Guide of AD&D totally pulls that trick. There's a whole second, because at that point they have officially branded TSR official AD&D miniature lines. Mm-hmm. And the DM's guide pitches that pretty heavily. There's at least a page long section about if you get miniatures, get only official branded Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, all boldface caps miniatures. And me as a kid reading that at age, 9 or 10 was like, oh, that's what I'm supposed to do. And yeah. I felt like I was missing out. I wasn't really playing D&D without the miniatures that the book talked about. And it wasn't until much later that I saw these quotes from Gygax. And he reiterated that in 2003. That wasn't a one-off comment. He was asked about it in 2003, said the same thing. He never used miniatures when he played D&D. Many years before I realized that.
What were the first miniatures you ever bought? And when was that?
Holy moly, what a great question. It was very late. It was very late. It was, I'm pretty sure it was around when we were, you and I were playing together, and it was around the inception of third edition. You know, and at that point I had a job, obviously, and I had some disposable income. And so I probably wasn't until I was about 30 years old and I started to get, you know, I started to get miniatures like this one for the characters that I was playing in our second, third edition.
So,
games.
So this all those years, decades even, you went of feeling like you were playing the game wrong because you didn't own the miniatures. That's wild.
100%.
That's wild. 100%.
Absolutely.
I very distinctly remember the first set of miniatures I ever got as a kid. It had to be maybe 88, 89. I grew up in an area where there were no game stores. The best I could hope for was like a little back corner of the local comic shop would have a bookshelf or two of product. And I could, whatever I could get is what I could get. And certainly miniatures were not on the list, right? I was lucky to get some books. Usually disparate stuff. I think I bought the Orange Spine first edition books actually at a toy store. So anyway, long story short here. I was growing up in New York, and I was aware that in New York City, I lived outside of there, that there was a dedicated game store called the Complete Strategist. And I think I was aware of this because of like ads in the back of a Dragon magazine. And I was just taken by the idea of a whole store of gaming stuff. Yeah. And so begged my mom to take me there. So one day we got on the train, went into the city and got to the store. And I'm poking around. Obviously, I have to buy something. And I found a box of miniatures that were specifically the Dungeon Board Game branded miniatures. It was a nice arrangement actually of your typical adventurer types, right? And that was appealing to me, right? What random monster do I know? I want the PCs. And so this one comes with a fighter and a magic user and an elf and a dwarf and et cetera, all the sort of core stuff. I was like, that's perfect. Let me buy that. And that's how I became aware of the Dungeon Board Game. Cause I had this thing and it came with supplemental rules because it also came with, here's some extra character types you can use in your Dungeon Board Game.
Oh, really?
And I was like, what's the Dungeon Board Game? I had no idea. And so I had to go out and get the Dungeon Board Game.
What? So you and I have both met Dave McGarry, who made that at this point. What are the extra character types?
So it comes with a gnome illusionist. Comes with a gnome illusionist. I remember that. I think there are four of them. I think maybe, is there no cleric? There might be no cleric in the original board game, right? Yeah, it comes with a cleric.
That's right.
Comes with a cleric, a gnome illusionist. I think, no, there is paladin in the original. I can't remember all four of the extra classes it adds. The funny thing, too, is it's very classic miniature casts. If you see the miniatures that came with this set, you will probably recognize them because then TSR repackaged those miniatures again and again and again. I probably ended up with 2 to 3 copies of any one of those miniatures because they got so reused by TSR back in that time.
Interesting. You know, I never thought about the fact that the Dungeon Board Game doesn't have a cleric in it. So I guess that once again highlights my ongoing argument that clerics aren't really essential to playing D&D, and I should add that to one of my lists at some point.
But does have a paladin. Right? Does have a paladin?
No, it doesn't.
No. Okay, well then that must be one of the other four ones.
No,
that come in the box.
It's elf, hero, superhero, wizard is the original dungeon.
There you go. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So paladin is clearly one of the ads in that little box that I bought.
You know,
you go.
On that
and
theme,
I took them home. I took them home, and I remember this. I tried to paint them with watercolor paints. That does not work. Don't do that.
I think many of us, right? And I think at some point I might have painted something with plastic car model paints, right?
Yeah, those oil-based paints. Yeah,
it doesn't work great either. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, on that point, okay. Here, I'm going to revise my first miniatures I bought actually, because on that point. And I didn't think of it because it's a different genre. I think maybe mid late 80s, you know, I had Star Frontiers, which was a, you know, spaceship fighting game, and I had Marvel Superheroes, and I thought, and Marvel Superheroes in the 80s was very heavily miniature based. Everything had specific maps, all the distances were given in like number of areas, things like that. And so instead of the paper counters, I thought I should really go out and get model miniatures for the superheroes. And I went into the store and I found this box that, to my eye, looked like generic superheroes.
I had to share that one. William says nail polish doesn't work either. Go on, Dan.
We've all gone through this. So I went in the store and I saw a box that was looked to my eye like generic superheroes. They weren't Marvel superheroes. They weren't, you know, yep. Superman, Batman. I was like, great, I can get this and I can use it for generic heroes that my players are playing in Marvel superheroes, and I bring it home. And so, to make a long story short, what it was a Watchmen set. It was a DC Watchmen heroes set, right, with Dr. Manhattan and the Owl, right, and things like that, and the Silk Spectre and things like that. And so it's a little bit embarrassing because nowadays, obviously, everybody recognizes those as they're very iconic, you know, characters that you obviously can't use to stand in for generic heroes. And so I didn't actually get to use them, but I actually think that might have actually been the first miniatures that I ever got was actually the Watchmen miniature set.
So I think I'd be remiss if I didn't point out, because I think it came up in the chat somewhere, and BJ used to say this all the time, is there were certain board games that came out in that kind of late 80s era that a lot of us, I think, bought as fodder for our D&D games, right? So you're looking at like games like Battlemasters, HeroQuest, Warhammer Quest, any of that stuff that was sort of a partnership between GW and... Who was it, Mattel or... Milton Bradley.
Yes, right. I think you're right. You're right. Yeah. Right. And so I have a box right here of exactly what you're talking about, right? And so this was, this might have been a game called Lionheart, maybe, I'm thinking, is what it was. And so I totally did that same thing. You know, maybe now we're talking 15 or 20 years ago of I went into a toy store and they had a clearance on this, actually. They were like, oh, no one's buying this game, so we're going to sell it for $20 per box. And I bought out their stock. And so I bought several boxes to have a couple hundred of those. And then I was in the situation of, well, now I got to paint all those suckers. And I actually assembled and painted about half of them.
Shadzar says HeroQuest is for HeroQuest, which is totally, I 100% agree. HeroQuest is an amazing board game. I may have multiple boxes of it in my closet. But... also, yes, I totally use those miniatures for D&D.
So I think for many of us, I mean, again, coming from that, like we were young and we didn't have access to it, I was still, you know, I was still going at this from a place of privation, right? So it was like, you know, like huge boxes of cheap miniatures. I'm gonna, you know, buy hundreds of those, and that's clearly what I need. And even to this day, you know, I go into the local toy store, and they've got like a bag of like 100 soldiers, right? 100 cheap plastic soldiers or skeletons or something like that. And it's still actually hard for me not to buy it as soon as I see it, because I'm like, I need hundreds of miniatures, even though I generally don't use it in my gaming for D&D.
You know, this we're probably seriously dating ourselves here, because I feel like this day and age, it's less of an issue, right? That now you have lots of manufacturers of pre-painted plastic miniatures that are relatively cheap. You can go onto Hero Lab and you can like specifically spec out exactly your figure, and I think maybe even have it painted, right? And they'll ship it to you, right? Like the modern manufacturing processes plus the internet have made all of these issues we're talking about kind of moot.
You're totally right. You're totally right. When they started coming out with, I mean, so obviously when we were kids, your only option was metal miniatures, you know, lead-based metal miniatures. And so when they started to come out with cheaper plastic stuff for fantasy specifically, that was a huge leap forward. Two, when they started coming pre-painted, was a huge leap forward. And three, the fact that you can get them, you know, shipped to you now is like a whole wholly different world than when we started out.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I still have the brain damage. I still have the brain damage from being, you know, without for so many years that I see that stuff. And I'm like, I need to get it because it won't be here again.
Okay, so I want to jump way back here to a comment that David sent us, if I can find it. Because I do think that... you know, a little bit that access to miniatures has maybe impacted the game here and there, right, as to whether or not the game relies on miniatures or not, whatnot. But David said, without minis, I found I can't effectively run as interesting / unique encounters. So, and that's really an interesting point. I feel like that is the yin and yang, the give and take of do you use miniatures or not, right? They, yes, adding miniatures allows you to ramp up the complexity of the scene without having to right. spend a lot of painful time trying to describe what something looks like to your players and possibly have miscommunication errors and possibly have that impact the gameplay. On the other hand, yeah. I think the downside is you have to, oftentimes, to get that level of complexity, you have to pre-plan it. Right, you got to spend a lot of time either yeah. setting up miniatures, setting up terrain, or drawing stuff out, or whatever. And it a little bit, I think, takes away from your ability to on the fly, you know, envision yeah. anything. Right, like sort of the promise of yeah. D&D, where anything can happen. Right, I like that ability right. to say I don't feel shoehorned by what miniatures I have or what terrain I have, because whatever right. situation the players get into, we'll just imagine that and do it.
I think you're right. Do you mind if I read another Gygax quote here on
yeah,
that point,
go
actually?
For it. Yeah, please do.
So in 2003, Gygax was very active on the EN World site, and he had a whole Q&A where people would just ask him all day long, and I think he made thousands and thousands of responses. So in 2003, he was asked about that exact same thing, and he said, I don't usually employ miniatures in my RPG play. We ceased that when we moved from Chainmail Fantasy to D&D. I have nothing against the use of miniatures, but they are generally impractical for a long and freewheeling campaign play where the scene and the opponents can vary wildly in the course of about an hour. The GW folks use them a lot, but they are fighting set-piece battles, as is usual with miniature gaming. I do not believe that fantasy miniatures are either good or bad for fantasy RPG in general. If the GM sets up the gaming sessions based on their use, the resulting play is great from my standpoint. It is mainly a matter of having the painted figures and a big tabletop to play on. So that's exactly Gygax's same justification for, you know, if D&D is set up with, you know, these big wandering monster tables, at any particular moment you might roll up any particular monster in the game is, you know, how it was originally set up. That mm-hmm. definitely fights a bit against the need to pre-plan, prepare, set up architecture, right, and yep. know exactly what's going to happen in advance.
Yep. I mean, this is too many conflicting thoughts I wanted to get out of my head there all at once. You know, I think that really succinctly states, and there was a bit in the earlier quote that you read as well, of my preferred state of being able to mix and match all the styles, right? I'm running a campaign, yeah. I want to start with a baseline of expectation, no miniatures, unless we feel we need them. And don't be yeah. afraid to say, hey, we need the miniatures. And then we will upgrade to battle mats. We will upgrade to whatever, you know, or just draw. Sometimes I just draw on a whiteboard. I've done that a lot, right? Where
yeah.
like I have a whiteboard on the wall and I just draw roughly here's what the map looks like. And then I just use letters of here's player A, here's player yeah. B, C, whatever, or initials of their character names usually. Just to so everybody know where everything is. Okay, great. That's really fast. You know, next yeah. step up is, okay, let's actually have miniatures on a wet erase mat, a battle mat, right?
Yeah.
Or okay, now let's use real miniatures and 3D terrain and et cetera, et cetera. As I get right. more into that side of it, then it's more for what Gygax was talking about, are those set pieces, which I also want, right? I also do want right. some sessions yeah. where, okay, I've been thinking about this big encounter that we're going to have. We all know we're headed towards it. I'm going to plan it out yeah. and I'm going to set it up and we're going to have this giant epic encounter. You know, again, usually right. for those climactic moments.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you and I have both had good experiences with that of like running a, you know, classic D&D session, maybe having like a big dungeon, not knowing exactly where the players are going to go, doing most of it narratively to begin with. And then as the session kind of gets deeper, we pull out more of a battle, you know, pull out a battle map. Yeah. We start pulling out miniatures to clarify. And then, you know, there is a layer of the big bad, you know, villain at some point, and you kind of think that's where the big treasure is. They're probably going to get there sometime. And so if you have, you know, maybe not actually physically laid out before the game starts, but if you do have in mind that I do have the pieces to set that up and a couple of special set pieces when they get there, that can make for a really nice climax in yeah. like kind of a long D&D session. We've had really good experiences. And I remember that, right? I remember some of our biggest things like going through Rappahannock, and I very, you know, have a very visceral memory of the setup of the miniatures and the pieces in the battle map that showed up in the climactic, you know, fight scene when we got to what turned out to be the end. No. Couldn't have predicted to begin with. In fact, you were not supposed to go there. There was one place where you were specifically not supposed to go. It was completely insane that you got there. It didn't make any sense at all, but you got to the, like, the lair that you know, was way over your heads. And it was like a really amazing, amazing scene when I mapped it out.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, I think that's, I guess I feel like that's my major point of advice to anyone is don't try to, narrow your mind too much on any angle, right? Be as prepared as you can with as many different options as possible. And don't pigeonhole yourself into, well, I'm not a miniatures guy or I need miniatures all the time. Try to live in the in-between if you can. Anyway, that's what works for me. That's what I like a lot. And I've tried really hard in multiple occasions to plant a flag and say, nope, I'm going to be a no miniatures guy, or we're going to do all miniatures. It's going to be big and elaborate. I don't know. Those absolutes just don't work, I find.
Me too. I agree.
So the funny thing is, I think you and I both went through a phase of like when we were going through original old school stuff, we were like, oh, we don't need miniatures. This is great. This is freeing, right? I don't need all this stuff. I can just, have this tiny bundle of content that I carry around and we can play anything and it's great and wonderful. And then we started, I think as you were hinting before, you and I started running a game, a convention game that we call Boss Fight for Breakfast, which is like the polar opposite. We've got a battle mat and we've got an elaborate set piece, and the whole game is just this one big elaborate set piece with lots of miniatures. And it's amazing and fun.
It's one of our favorite things to do, right? It's one of our favorite things to do, And it looks great, and the players seem to always have a good experience with it. And sure enough, that's what we're doing there. Now, and again, it is one set piece. We know what it's going to be when we go in. It's not a surprise to us running it. And it is different than if you were doing a sandbox D&D, wilderness exploration where you didn't know where the players were going to go, and you didn't know how the dice were going to come up, and you didn't know what wandering monsters were going to happen. We should do another episode just on wandering monsters and how that affects your game, because now it turns out that this has a whole major reflection on whether you can use miniatures effectively or not, actually.
I think like miniatures, I will have a complex answer to wandering monsters. It's just, I just don't think there's cut and dry answers to any of this stuff. You know, you got to have as many tools in the toolbox as you can and the ability to pull out the right tool at the right moment.
I do find the answer always tends to be, well, you need both, right? Anytime anybody says, is it A or B, the correct answer is almost, well, you need both, obviously. So I do agree with that. How many, at this point, your miniature collection has been acquired mostly how? Is it pre-painted stuff, or is it stuff that you've painted, or?
I have so many different things. Now, the interesting thing is, there was a period of time, maybe about 10 years ago, where I was super into painting miniatures, and I painted a lot of them. And again, it depends on what I'm trying to build, or what I'm trying to play, or what I'm into at that time. You'll see right here over my left shoulder, right, there's a little display case of some miniatures on display. At the bottom, we have a couple of Warhammer Fantasy battles. I think that's my black coach and my orc wyvern rider. And at the top, actually, I'm trying to point, and it's... there we go.
You're getting it.
Yeah, great. The top, there's actually a display piece I built to contain my Mordheim warband. So I was playing Mordheim, which is a small band fantasy Warhammer, sort of skirmish game. So you need like, 6 to 12 miniatures for that. And so I built this whole fancy display stand to carry them around in. So where are the majority of my miniatures coming from? So I like painting miniatures. So I generally am painting my own and buying them wherever, stealing them from board games or have old ones or buy... there was a while where I was buying a lot of Warhammer Fantasy stuff. Then I went, here's a crazy thing. I went deep into 10 millimeter for a little while. I actually have some right here to show. I don't know anybody else who did this, but here you go. Here's some 10 millimeter fantasy miniatures. I know if I get them too close to the camera, it probably won't focus on them.
Hold your hand up behind them. Hold your hand up behind them, and then it'll get focused on your hand, probably. Your hand behind the miniatures. There you go. That usually helps. There you go. Okay. That works. See?
There it is. So those are 10 millimeter figures. I have tons of them. And now, no, of course, we're not focusing properly. I'm over here. I have tons of those, and they're super fun to paint because they're so much faster and easier to paint than your big, I know what we call 25 millimeter, but are really 30 millimeter. Mm-hmm. So I made a ton of those, and I was actually, I think it was around when you were developing Book of War that I started getting really deep in those, because I found if I use those and your 10-to-1 figure to man ratio, I could do enormous battles, and that was super fun.
And we've run one at your place that was actually part of your D&D campaign that was like a magnificent spectacle, actually, that I think we both have on our blogs.
Yeah.
In some place. Yeah. Using your 10 millimeter.
It had like blocks of like 20 10 millimeter skeletons, which is representing 200 skeletons, right? And that's just one unit over here. That's super fun. I really enjoyed that. I just like the scale really you can get on a table space at the amount of terrain you can get is neat. Anyway, got into that. Haven't bought or painted many miniatures at all recently. Have a fair collection. Got very unhappy about getting into that state that I think so many of us got into of like my backlog of unpainted miniatures is enough to fill 3 lifetimes. So why am I still buying more miniatures? Totally. And then got into OD&D where I'm favoring not using miniatures whenever possible. So why am I buying all this stuff?
Yeah. And the same dynamic for me is when we got into the third edition era together, and third edition was very miniature heavy. It wasn't totally mandatory, but it was really quite heavy, as I think some people have pointed out in the comments. Like a lot of rules had maps and grids in the books for here's what the grid of this particular spell will do. That was when I went through my biggest miniature acquisition phase. And I haven't been doing it very much in the last 10 years or so. I have a pretty good supply. Like running the Book of War playtest Saturday nights here with Isabel, I'm digging it out again for the first time actually in like a year or two. So I'm going through all my boxes and using it all of a sudden in the last couple of weeks. But I haven't, like you, I haven't acquired or painted anything new in a number of years.
So let's really, before we run out of time, I want to talk about how this impacts us now that everything's becoming digital. Yeah. There was I think a comment earlier about how like, well, maybe this makes things easier because you're just downloading images off of the internet, right? You don't even have to own giant collections. You don't have to paint tons of miniatures. Just download stuff and off you go. Does that make it more or less palatable to use miniatures?
I wonder. I mean, I feel like so with me experimenting with the virtual tabletops in the last week or two, it's the same kind of thing of like, if I wind up committing in that direction, how quickly am I going to become really picky about, do I have the exact right image resource for this character or this monster, right? If I get a snow orc image, am I suddenly going to be finding that unacceptable for like a jungle orc character? And how much time am I going to start spending tracking down the exact right image resource? I mean, maybe that's a personal issue that I need to wrestle with.
I don't think so. I mean, I think it harkens back to the same problem that we have with physical miniatures, which is it still requires some amount of setup, right? Yeah. You got to go. Are you going to, if you're in the middle of as Gygax calls it, a freewheeling campaign, and you get a random encounter with a bunch of purple worms, are you going to slow the game down to go hunt down the right miniatures and the right, you know, map image to set something up in your VTT? Or are you just going to say, let's just theater mine this, guys?
Right. And even for like the architecture, right? So you have in the past, you've acquired a pretty good supply of Dwarven Forge architecture, which we break out occasionally for our D&D games. And so like I was thinking about the equivalent on the virtual tabletop of how quickly can I, you know, should I, if I run games like that, should I verbally describe the rooms of the dungeon like normal? Or can I very quickly just draw rectangles on the screen to show what it looks like? Or do I need to prepare in advance map layouts? And so at least the other day I was trying to practice, like, how quickly can I snap to the grid, just a rectangle and corridors, and now do I need to draw the door? That was the place where I actually gave up of, like, do I need to draw the door? Can I just say there's a door here or not? And I was like, here I go down the pipe once again.
Yep. I mean, I found the same thing when we were doing our solo game, and I was showing off D20 Pro. You know, I spent a little time because I thought, I'm not doing D20 Pro justice if I don't sit here and spend a little time setting up a really cool map. And we did that at the very beginning of our video, where I was like, this is this isn't even part of the adventure. I just want to show you guys what D20 Pro can do, because it's really impressive. Yeah. But I had to spend a bunch of time up front to set that up. So great for your big fancy set piece, but for your freewheeling, I just need, we're at a crossroads and you got jumped by three orcs, chuck them on the table. You know, I want rectangles for where the, you know, wagons are. Maybe not as good. I don't know. I feel like it's actually hasn't changed the problem at all, right? Like, you still want all the different tools.
Yeah.
I want to be able to do purely vocal description, theater of the mind, and then when it gets a little more complicated, I want to slap some rectangles down and just go here's a marker, just go. And then I also want to be able to set up elaborate, fancy showpieces for that, like, okay, this battle's been coming for weeks, and we're going to finally do it. I've set it up. Let's go.
That's a good point. You know, I guess I've been doing that almost forever, because I guess I remember as a kid having the Hall of the Fire Giant King adventure, right, that you've gone through twice. But now you've gone through at least twice, depending on how you count it, with me. And I remember as a kid sitting down, and there's a far deep last bastion era that if adventurers do well, everybody retreats to, and it's the last holdout zone for the fire giants. And I remember mapping that out by hand, you know, 1 inch per 10 feet on a giant piece of poster paper when I was a kid. Not for every single room in that enormous, you know, in that enormous dungeon, but I do remember laying out the culminating final bastion for a giant, you know, miniature battle at the time, probably with cardboard counters, which is what I would use.
You know, let me call out here. Interesting thing is something I've been doing recently at conventions. I'm going to call out a product called gaming paper. And specifically what gaming paper is it's just a big roll of paper. It sort of looks and feels a bit like wrapping paper, and it's kind of plain brown, and it's got a 1-inch grid on it. Comes in big rolls. You can just roll it out, draw on it. I usually draw on it on Sharpie because it's permanent, but who cares, because I'm just going to toss it when I'm done. It's sort of an alternative to your wet erase battle mat or whatnot. The reason I'm calling it out is this is a habit I've recently developed, especially for convention games, where I'm running the same content over and over again. I got into this habit where there were a couple places where I knew in this room, typically when I run this adventure, a big battle will happen in this room, and it's very complex and exciting and interesting, and I want more detail on the map, and I don't want to slow my game down by having to draw all this stuff on the wet erase battle mat. So I usually run the game with, I have the wet erase battle mat, and I use that on the fly for any random stuff. And then when we get to that encounter and I go, oh, what do you know? This encounter's happening again. I pull out that pre-drawn gaming paper and I go, boom, here you go. And it's a nice wow moment too. Everybody's like, whoa, it's all this detail, and you foresaw that this was going to happen. And I'm like, well, you know, 9 times out of 10 it happens, so might as well be prepared for it, right? Sort of one of the odd things. So it's kind of one of the odd things about running convention games, right? Especially running the same convention game multiple times, you start to get a feel for how that game plays.
Right. And it's kind of two advantages, because one, you're saving time, and two, you're getting more detail. So once again, if you can pre-plan and kind of guess that it's going to happen, you're saving time at the table, you're getting additional detail. And if you run it more than once, then you get to recoup that time multiple times.
I mean, I know there's really some DMs who do that for like everything. And I think you and I both push back on that a little bit, because it just starts to border a little too much into the railroad territory.
Right. And we enjoy having surprise encounters, right? I think that we both have had times where something did come up, maybe a wandering monster or something like that we did not expect in advance, and it turned out to be a really special feature that maybe the whole campaign turned on, that was great for us and great for the players because we didn't see it coming. We had to totally improvise it. So I would never want to entirely remove that from my D&D gaming.
I mean, this is the secret sauce. I'm going to give it away here. This is the secret sauce of Boss Fight for Breakfast. This is a 2-hour convention game that Dan and I co-GM. He's the adversary. I'm the referee, and it's 2 hours. And the whole point was we were going to conventions and couldn't like scrape ourselves out of bed any earlier than 10, but wanted to play a game before lunchtime. And I was like, how do I cram a full adventure into 2 hours? It's just not possible. And what I ended up doing was, we'll just play the climax scene. We'll just play the climax scene. Totally stole the climax scene of other adventures I had run, right? So other adventures I'd run where I go like, you remember that time when this and this and this all happened and we got into this situation and you have all these effects going on and whatever, all this, you know, interesting. So I just took all that, wrote it all down. And went, you know, the first 5 minutes of the game is, okay, this and this and this and this happened. And you're here. Go.
Yeah. It's really spectacular like that. And all and I, Dan, am here to destroy you. So just keep that in mind.
I mean, that's the newer wrinkle to that adventure that we added. That is just even ramped up the excitement even more. Is oh, and there's a heel, and good luck.
It's so funny how these things do come full circle, because when you and I first met and first worked at a video game company, you were working on that wrestling game, and I have kept wrestling at arm's length for my entire life. Like, that's not really for me. It's a little weird. I'm not into fake stuff. I don't know. And then you come back and I'm like, oh, now I'm basically playing a wrestling heel all the time in our games. So it's just now I need to dig into that apparently, because that's apparently where I've landed.
So that's a particular game I love running that is very miniatures heavy, and I love it, and we'll run it a lot more in the future. But yeah, I guess for my campaigns, I want that now and again. I want that.
And I will also
that happen
say, I mean,
every
I
session.
Like...
That'd be too much. Sorry,
yeah,
go on.
Yeah, and I'll say, I mean, I like wargaming too. I mean, I've always been kind of at least wargaming affiliated. I've never really had... you know, I actually didn't play Warhammer Fantasy specifically, but I had, you know, the old TSR D&D battle system, and I know that many people pick up my Book of War game and still, you know, play it with the old battle system figures that are just, you know, cardboard as a starter. When I was a kid, I would, you know, just take cardboard boxes and chop them into counters is how I would do that. So I enjoy wargaming. You know, I enjoy playtesting the, you know, my Book of War rules that coordinate with D&D really well. And once you have a bunch of miniatures on hand, if you have a cupboard full of miniatures for your wargaming, it's really hard to avoid going, oh, you know, it'd be really neat for my D&D game is just grab some of that stuff that I already have. And so it's very quick to funnel your wargaming miniatures into your D&D game, and it does look pretty nifty when you do that.
I wonder if this exists at all for 5th edition folks, but like I feel like I really have to strongly plug Book of War here for anybody who's running classic D&D, 1st edition, OD&D, basic, whatever. Book of War really very neatly streamlines right in there. I ran a game of this online recently where we basically lived in that sort of nebulous... Sometimes we're on a hex map moving a single figure around collectively as a group. Sometimes we zoom in and we're doing encounter level fights. And sometimes we have mass battle and then we get a Book of War and we chuck that in too. Nice.
That's the point. When the original D&D rules have these, oh, you run into 300 bandits, you run into 200 goblins or stuff like that. I grew up going, well, how the hell do I handle that? What happens there?
Yeah.
And multiple adventures that actually kind of thing happen. So that was exactly the use case that I was trying to solve of like when that does pop up by accident, not something I expect in my D&D game, how can we play that out quickly?
So the funny thing for me, and to just bring it back to like playing online, the way I did that to play online, because I'm like, I don't know where this game's going to go. We're going to have all these different layers and all these different levels and who knows what encounter they're going to have. Ultimately, I gave up on all the virtual tabletops and I just connected another camera and pointed it at my table and said, all right, I'm going to use miniatures, right? I'm going to use minis. Whiteboard. I used a whiteboard and I used the outdoor survival board. And I just had all this stuff on the wings, and I would just put it in front of the other camera and off you go.
There you go. That's possibly a smart way to do that. And of course the Vorpal board, virtual tabletop is kind of set up expecting that and has a bunch of tools for different players to be able to point at the image of the camera of the actual miniatures kind of thing. So they actually are set up to expect that.
That product cannot come out soon enough, man. I want to use that right now. Come on, Warple Board guys, get that thing out. I want to use that so much.
Now I'll say the other thing. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to add in just a funny aside here of the one thing I did learn from that game is that my my little 10mm figures, which I was using I can't remember what, just to try and get more on screen at once, right? Turns out a terrible choice. They're really hard to see on a video camera, as we just saw as me trying to focus on them. 10mm, that's too small for your webcam. Yeah.
That's good to know. That's a mistake I don't have to make myself in the future. That's good. There
you, because you're considering buying a ton of 10mm figures.
Well, I mean, not today, but I, you know, who knows what future Dan's going to do? It's kind of a random number generator. The other thing I'll say, you know, is that I've been wrestling with personally is if you are going to publicize this stuff, right? If you are going to maybe stream publicly your game, right? Now you have the additional problem of, you know, miniatures and doing a lot of graphical stuff is great if people are going to watch a video version, maybe on YouTube or Twitch. But if your viewers want to consume it by way of audio podcast, all that stuff gets stripped out. And maybe your podcast isn't intelligible if you are relying heavily on a bunch of graphics and visuals and miniatures. And maybe you want to avoid that if you want to deliver podcast format.
Interesting. This is a really interesting point because I have been listening to Critical Role via podcast form for a long time now. Okay. And every now and then there's a fight part where I'm listening in and going like, well, I'm kind of following what's going on. I sort of know, but I'm kind of like not really paying super close attention. But something in the back of my head is saying like, maybe I got to go look this one up on YouTube later and watch it because it sounds cool. Sounds like it looks great. And I need to go back and look at it.
Right.
It's interesting.
We saw the new, there's a new D&D Beyond webcast that started a couple days ago, and they don't have any visual elements that I can tell whatsoever. It's purely verbal for the whole two hours. And so I'm guessing someone probably thought, you know, we're going to tune this specifically for podcast delivery.
It could be, but I would also point out, like, I think most streams are that. I think Critical Role is more the outlier of that. They actually do show miniatures. Although, you know, maybe when Vorpal Board comes out, maybe this will change for everybody and we'll see a lot more.
Yeah, I feel like I've seen enough Vorpal Board stuff and I've seen enough Roll 20 stuff that I've started to like kind of expect some kind of visual graph paper, something. But maybe I'm in a minority niche on that at the moment.
Are there particular streams that feature Roll 20 that you're watching? Actually, I feel like I haven't seen that and I need to go look that up.
Yeah, probably just ours on Tuesday nights.
I would be really shocked if Roll20 wasn't pushing more for more streams content. So I feel like that's now on my list of things to go look for. Interesting.
Yep, exactly. Well, I feel like we just scratched the surface on this. So I am currently surrounded by stacks of stuff that I was thinking about showing on the stream, and we didn't even get to that point. So maybe this was miniatures part one, and maybe we'll have to come back to this very rich topic another day. I didn't show off my tower, and I didn't show off. I was going to talk about constructing this. And I was going to show off this thing here that I got there. I have that upside down technically, right? I got this one here, but I didn't get to that. So
I hear you. I have a 10 millimeter. That's a 10mm tower built out of a T10.
We've had some hellacious fights on that tower. I distinctly remember like really critical die rolls as I had monsters fighting up through that tower trying to eliminate people on it, actually. So.
Yep.
I distinctly remember really hellacious fights around that. Yeah,
crazy. All right, so obviously there's a lot more thoughts to be had, but let's see if we can focus in on one thing. We were talking about sort of miniatures and how that translates into your tastes for online virtual tabletop type stuff. Any final thoughts on how having to play digitally online has affected use of miniatures or not affected use of miniatures?
I mean, I feel like I'm just a beginner at this, so I wouldn't want to begin to hold out any kind of thesis that people should hold their hats on, because I'm just learning about this myself. All I know is that from many years of, you know, tabletop play, we have vacillated the theory radically from, you know, playing with no miniatures to you got to have miniatures to got to have not have miniatures. And I think that we've discovered that having both in your toolbox is a really nice place to be, and being dogmatic about in either direction is, you know, limits your play.
Yeah.
So what do you think, Paul? How do you expect that to play out in terms of online stuff?
I think there, it, interestingly, I suspect, you know, it's going to radically change the how we go about sort of using miniatures or not using miniatures, but it's not going to change the big pillars of making that choice of when do I need visual representation and when do I not. I feel like, you know, that the big tent poles remain the same. The game remains the same. if anyone knows what I'm referring to there.
That's good. That's good. That makes me feel comfortable, actually.
Yeah, I think so. But certainly, I don't know. I think that we're going to see a lot more techniques about how to do it, you know, from stuff like virtual tabletops like Roll20 or D20 Pro or Fantasy Grounds to Vorpal Board. Personally, very excited for Vorpal Board. But is it going to be the universal hammer that fixes all role-playing woes? I'd be pretty shocked. My one experience tells me there is no one universal tool that makes everything easy.
I am writing down the phrase for a new magic item someday called universal hammer.
Nice.
That's a great turn of phrase. Awesome. That's great.
Awesome.
So if
any of our viewers have any thoughts on this, specifically like how they've adapted to, from their miniature heavy or non-miniature use into the virtual space, I'm very curious about that. You know, or just generally miniature use in gaming. I know it's a hot topic. I'm sure there's a lot of very different opinions. I've seen actually that our chat has been actually pretty active today. Not surprised.
I gotta go back and read all that chat. Yeah, I gotta go back and read all that chat because it's been way too fast. It's been way too dense for me to follow while we were talking. So I need to go back right after the show and read all that stuff. It's been great.
Yeah. So, but please keep the conversation going in our chat, in our comment section here of this video. We would love to hear from you. And maybe that will help us figure out what the focus of Miniatures Episode 2 will be down the road.
I totally agree with that. Totally agree. And remember to anybody maybe watching for the first time that you can like and follow and subscribe to us on YouTube and Twitter and Twitch under the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites.
Yes, and please do so. We would appreciate it very much. Likewise, you can listen to our show in audio-only podcast format. You can find those podcasts on our website at wanderingdms.com, as well as various podcast carriers such as iTunes and Google Podcasts. If you are listening to our podcast on one of those other carriers, please take a moment to rate and review us. That helps us out as well.
It definitely would. As usual, thanks again to our patrons who support our show every month. We could not do what we're doing with the show without you. And if you would like to join them in supporting Wandering DMs, please do visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. We currently have 4 shows a week here on the channel. Look for Paul and me playing a solo game Tuesday night. Look for 10 Dead Rats Thursday night. And if you are deep into miniature wargaming, please tune in Saturday night for Dan and Isabel playing my miniature war game, Book of War, that's compatible with D&D. And you can see all of our miniatures on the table at that time. For the chat show, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So we hope that you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.